All this week on The Conversation, we've been looking at tourism with our Traveling Money series. Here's some of what we've heard.
Hi, this is Dr. Bob Lemon. Tourism once was a good thing. Now, if you just look at Oahu, it's a great example of a place that's been loved to death. It's been concreted over. Sorry, it's not what it used to be. And they're getting tacky experience. It's not real. The visitors aren't having real experiences. And when they do go out for real experiences, then there's no room for us. Thanks very much.
My name is Taylor, and I'm calling from Hawaiian Acres over on the Big Island. The islands themselves are a limited resource. Not everyone benefits directly from tourism dollars. Everyone shares the cost, but not everyone shares in the proceeds. The solution is to share the benefits of tourism with all of those who are affected by the visitor industry. There is an analogous situation in Alaska where mineral rights belong to the residents of the state. The limited resource, in this case oil, is extracted by those permitted to do so, and each year every resident receives a dividend check, which is their share of the proceeds.
We've been hearing from a great many people on these subjects, and we would like to hear from you live. So we're opening up the phone lines to take your calls, weighing in on Hawaii's tourism industry, inviting you to join in our discussion by calling 941-3689. Are from the neighbor islands of the mainland, 1-877-941-3689. Joining me and HPR News Director Bill Dorman in the studio is economist Paul Brubaker, Jeff Bolin, CEA of Sustainable Travel International, who just returned from the Global Tourism Summit, joins us by phone. Hi, Jeff. Have we got you patched in?
I sure hope so. I'm here.
All right. Thanks very much. Jeff, let me start with you. You've just been at the summit. Was it valuable for you?
Absolutely valuable, no question about it. It was well done. Some fantastic speakers, not only about what you might think of the mainstream tourism discussions, but getting you thinking about other topics. There was the head of the Iceland Tourist Board gave a fantastic talk yesterday.
Yeah.
One of the senior executives from Microsoft just talking about innovation and artificial intelligence and disruption. So, yeah, some really good conversations, very well done.
Are you seeing a lot of changes in the air?
No. I mean, I wish I were. I think in certain areas, I don't think the travel and the tourism industry has historically been the fastest moving, despite the fact that when the internet hit, where it hit most heavily and probably positively for most of us was in travel and tourism. The biggest e-commerce action has taken place there, Expedia and that the whole online travel agency.
Sure.
But probably not. I don't think there's a lot of innovation going on. To be honest, I think a lot of it is. I think it's nibbling along the edges. Higher prices, lower prices, more attractions, fewer attractions, and I don't think we're quite there yet in seeing that big change.
Let me bring in Paul Brubaker and kind of pose the same question, Paul. What do you think about what Jeff just said?
Sorry, what was the original question? I got distracted.
Well, is there a lot of change in the air in the visitor industry?
Have to agree with Jeff. It sounds like more of the same to me.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't at the conference, but there are changes in the data, but it doesn't seem like people are talking about those.
What are the changes in data telling you, Paul?
I think people have lost track of the fact that it's an export, the fact that for 30 years it's been in decline, and so we have more bodies, but we have less export receipts, which is, I'm pretty sure, the opposite of what people had in mind 30 years ago.
You won't often hear it described as being in decline, will you, Bill?
Yeah, I know, right? Well, that's because we, we report what people write in press releases and whatever propaganda apparatchik has written. The first paragraph is what's in the newspaper.
So what we do see, though, in terms of statistics, is that there are more visitors and they're spending more money in Hawaii. You're saying that's not the case?
More than what? I mean,
well, more than growth. I'm thinking of a growth chart. But actually, let me ask a slightly different question.
Let me just answer the first question, because it is the question. So total visitor expenditure last year was, what, $15.6 billion? Mm-hmm. That's the same as it was in 2005 in today's dollars.
Adjusting
or in 2016 dollars. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, we adjust for inflation.
Right.
So we're talking about real things here, not fake things. And that's the same as it was in the year 2000. In 1989, in 2016 dollars, it was $18.4 billion. This year it may be, you know, I'm guessing it's going to be 16.4-ish. So we're only $2 billion short of 1989, and we have 2 million more visitors. So, yeah, that would be the opposite of what most people thought.
So this concept, metrics, where you live and die as an economist,
yeah,
and everyone wants to measure everything, how does one measure and quantify the impact of tourism in Hawaii or any place else, but specifically in Hawaii? Because before you can judge an impact of something, you need to measure it, right? And whether that something is growing or declining.
Well, the place to start is the place we just started, which is how much money did we make?
Mm-hmm.
If we could make it a different way, like selling them something on eBay so they didn't have to come here, that would be, I mean, I would take that $18 billion. But, yeah, that's where you start. How much, right? That's what we're doing. We're selling them goods and services, and it's an export. So we start with how much money did we receive from those exports.
How about measuring, again, the cost or the impact of the tourism, of people coming to visit, whether that's on infrastructure, whether that's on roads, whether that's on in other ways of measuring? You know, you mentioned a great DBED study back from 2006 of one line about talking about the pressures caused by tourism. It says the point at which those pressures become a capacity constraint, that is a move from annoyance to intolerable, is not only a judgment call, it's also a moving target.
Well, you've also started a whole new conversation about what's a capacity constraint, which is
we'll get back to that. We'll get back to that.
But to the way you framed the question initially, you talked about congestion, I believe, and you sort of utilization issues. It's not clear to me how those are different from, right, if the tourist is in the car or the resident is in the car, how is that different? If the tourist is on the trail or the resident is on the trail, it's the same thing.
So the
point is that if you believe there are impacts that need to be managed, then they just need to be managed. That doesn't have anything to do with tourism per se. It needn't have anything to do with tourism per se.
Well, other than I guess it's back to that point of how do you isolate what the impact of tourism is in terms of impact on the economy.
You know, the typical way to do it is you use some kind of an analytical or mathematical framework to trace impacts across industries and, you know, occupations or employment and so on and so forth, tax revenues. And everybody sort of has their little stakeholder thing. But I think in terms of the point to which you're alluding, if I can sort of interpret where I thought we were going, the thing that concerns most people are the same things that arise when we start talking about congestion, and, you know, they're basically congestion externalities is what we call them in economics, the unintended, uncompensated negative impacts. And they tend to be nonlinearities, right? They tend to be it's all good until the last 20 guys showed up. Traffic is just fine until UH starts, and then all of a sudden the entire island bogs because 20,000 students went to campus. And it's sort of the same thing. I mean, there's another dimension of it, which we can get to later, which has to do with the app-averse. But, yeah, I mean, it's the utilization is the issue that most people are upset about. And, you know, I don't tell people where the secret spots are, right? I use the Jedi mind trick. There is no surf.
Well,
these are not
Paul
the surf spots you were looking for.
Paul and Bill, I want to bring listeners into this because a lot of the calls that we get concern impacts. But first, let's start off with a recording of a call, one of the first calls we got. Let's hear from Corey Harden.
Hi, this is Corey Harden in Hilo. I hear always about how much tourists are spending. I would like to have someone figure out the cost of tourism. Higher home prices, because resorts jack up land values. Cost of building airports, harbors, roads, parks, and maintaining them. And then the non-monetary costs, quality of life. Thank you.
we keep coming back to quality of life in all these discussions. Let me patch in another caller. This is Michelle from Lahaina, Maui. Michelle, you there?
Hi. Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
We're sort of veering toward the subject of the impacts of tourism, Michelle. I gather that's what you wanted to mention.
Yes, that's one of my biggest concerns on Maui and throughout Hawaii. We should be really concerned with the quality of our water, because if we don't have healthy reefs, tourism is really going to be take a big dive. And we're trying to get a ban of oxybenzone and octinoxate, which have been scientifically proven to compromise the coral reefs, and we work very, very hard. I work with a couple different volunteer organizations to keep our reefs very healthy, but without the help of legislature to pass some laws, you know, laws have been passed in Mexico to protect their reefs, and they don't allow oxybenzone and octinoxate in their waters at all. There's a federal law there. Yet in Hawaii, we haven't been able to do that, and I really would like to see that ban to educate tourists and everyone to not use those toxic chemicals.
Let me ask Jeff Bolin of Sustainable Travel International to weigh on this, because Jeff, in your field, you're obviously very concerned, and people you work with are very concerned about that very thing, impacts that the whole thing of the quality of water being just one example. Yeah.
Well, just from the last several comments, both from the callers as well as the other folks on the show, I have to say that it's boosted my feeling even more about being at the conference, the summit. I feel like all of a sudden a lot of people were listening, because my drumbeat has been both with this and with other places around the globe. There's no expense line on anyone's profit and loss statement that aligns with the negative impacts of tourism. It's a tragedy of the commons. And so all these last few comments are kind of inspiring. I feel like people are listening, or at least four people are listening. So that's a plus. What's happening? The difference between sort of the data and the reality are the difference between talking about a place being a good destination because it has a lot of visitors versus the poke was amazing and I loved going surfing. Right? There's a numbers versus reality. So yeah, we're concerned about reef damage. We're concerned about overcrowding. We're concerned essentially about saying no one's accounting for the negative impacts of tourism. And when you don't quantify those impacts, they don't exist. They don't go on your P&L. You don't pay for them. And so that can be environmental degradation, coast, reef, forest. Undoubtedly, it's the social side as well. Right? I mean, I spoke recently to a group, and we were talking about overcrowding. That's the big word right now is over tourism. We think of it as overloved destinations, and that's certainly not exclusive to Hawaii. Right? There are protests in Barcelona and protests in Venice, and the response by some folks was, well, we've been promoting clean air and our clean water systems, and I said, you're missing the point. The point is people can't park, right? They can't find the affordable housing. The price of the milk is more expensive. All of this, which is a good, a positive, right? Tourism is supposed to be a positive. It makes us all feel good. We do it, by and large, out of choice to get a great experience. All of a sudden, isn't so positive. And I think that's the net result of what's going on in many respects in Hawaii, which is, and you can feed it into the discussion on Airbnb. You can feed it into the discussion on airlines and higher end product. You can feed it into a lot of these discussions, but it permeates. And so, if there's no tourist location and experience that's going to be positive if the locals don't want you there. And there's no going into the water where it's replaced sand or the reef is bleached out is a degradation of the asset. And what's happening is that the industry or these destinations, Hawaii and others, are not investing in that natural and human asset. And so you get a huge imbalance.
I think the problem, this is Paul again, I think the problem, as I see it, however, is that we're conflating two different problems. Tourism may or may not have anything to do with, or may not have more to do with environmental, cultural, natural resource stewardship issues per se. But their existence is something we should be concerned about, regardless of what the origins of those problems are. So, local people put on sunscreen. It's the sunscreen that's the problem, not the tourists. And I think everything we're talking about here reminds me that we seem to be living in a world where we're trying to assign negative outcomes to other people, like it's those guys from over there. And, you know, where the answers to all of the problems we're actually talking about are mitigate the negative externalities. There's not enough housing. Build more housing, for God's sake. What? I mean, is it that hard to figure out?
But I'm going to have to disagree for a moment. So that if we step away from Hawaii, and the, one of the callers just used the example of Mexico, so we do work in the Mesoamerican Reef. That's the second largest reef system in the world after the Great Barrier Reef. Talking about Cancun, Playa del Carmen, Cozumel, and that region. And it's really a four-country area, but those are the big areas where so the reef degradation is caused by two sources. One, the impact of agriculture and effluents from that, and two, and not necessarily in that order, and two, tourism and its associated growth. So
but
20,
reef
30 years ago when there was no, with very limited tourism and smaller communities, the reef was in better shape.
But I'm just saying if
grown, infrastructure has grown and tourism has grown, so effluents and waste from hotels and from other operations is a direct impact on it. So it's, yes, it's to say it's sunscreen is sunscreen, but if 9 million more people or 2 million more people are wearing sunscreen than yesterday, and those 2 million more are there for tourism, you know, it's hard to ignore the tourism.
See, but the answer to mitigating environmental degradation is not to have less tourists, which is the implication of blaming it on tourism or agriculture or whatever. It doesn't matter where the effluent originates. The point is to mitigate its impacts. It could be, you know, an industrial facility, but you would still want to mitigate the impacts.
Which is, and again, you would want to be able to measure the impact, which was my point. But actually, I think, Chris, we're moving on to some other calls, if we may.
Well, this is something that keeps resurfacing. I want to bring in Dee from Kona, because there's another issue that we keep hearing about. Dee, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Your concern is Airbnbs, and we've certainly...
Yeah, my comment is the Airbnb. Thank you for taking my call. I work in the visitor industry and the rent-a-car industry, which, you know, there's a lot of rent-a-cars. I don't know how regulated there are. Everyone does pay a road fee. But the Airbnb seems not regulated. You know, even your sunscreen, if the sunscreen is regulated and we don't have that sunscreen available, and we have a product in Hawaii that's viable with our culture, with our small island, you know. But when someone is coming in and they're just finding the most affordable Airbnb, which happens to be here on the Big Island, it impacts your affordable housing. Because if an owner can rent Airbnb for a few hundred dollars a night, violating any long-term, short-term rentals, they're not going to rent to a resident for $800 a month. You know, it's a math thing. And I think that a lot of it does have to do with our legislature, not the other person, definitely us and our representatives standing up and saying, this is our quality. We have quality, beautiful destination. This is how we do it here.
Dee, thanks very much for that. And, of course, Paul, that's an ongoing concern, right? Are Airbnbs falling through the cracks?
I think what I just heard is that you need more housing on the Big Island. So I agree
with pretty
that.
Much what you just said.
I mean, I think that's what we just said. The apps have changed the landscape, the economic landscape, by reducing the information asymmetry that used to that was mostly born by people who didn't know about, you know, where the cool places were or where the cheap places to stay were. And but, you know, complaining about Airbnb as the cause of a problem of lack of lodging or housing is like saying, you know, when travel agents were displaced by hotel websites, that the internet was the cause of the problem. The technology has improved. It's reduced the information asymmetries. It's made it easier to find affordable lodging. It made it easier to locate the cool places to go. And so we can't make more of the cool places. And mitigating the congestion pressures that arise may involve right? If there's too many people that you're not charging enough, that would be my first comment on that. But with housing or lodging, we're talking about a reproducible, a producible asset. And if there's a shortage of it, the solution is just to produce more of it. You can't produce more, Kilauea volcanoes. Pele will take care of that on her own. But Paul, you can produce more capacity if there's a housing shortage.
We've been, that's a solution that's often offered. Why doesn't anybody do it? There's got to be a...
My political theory is that by preventing or limiting the ability of people to build lodging or housing, it creates economic power, monopoly power, that supports the political regimes that have adopted the posture. So, right, if you look at the hotel room count or the transient visit, the measurement is important here. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the visitor plant inventory enumerations for Oahu today, they're essentially the same as they were in the late 1980s, around 1989, 1990. So that's not an accident, right? It's not that nobody net wanted to build another 10,000 lodging units on Oahu. It's that you're denied the ability to do it. And the people who can, which are the Ritz-Carltons and the Disney Aulanis and so on, and maybe the Mandarin Orientals, clearly, because we have an enumeration, those new units have simply displaced older units that have migrated out of the transient accommodation pool. But it gives the hotelier industry and more broadly, right, people who have undocumented vacation rentals and timeshare operators and whatnot a better economic position. Well, it gives them market power.
If we want fewer people to spend more money, it's not in our interest to build housing.
Well, or you can have Donald Trump just ban them from coming. It's kind of where you end up if we keep going down this road of, right, if sustainable the adjective actually means less, like when you say sustainable tourism, you actually mean less tourism, which some people, that's actually what they mean.
You know, here's a phrase.
That's where you end up.
In terms of sustainable tourism, a lot of people use the phrase ecotourism. I think one of our callers, Larry, South Kona, you're still there, Larry, had a point on that.
Yeah. Jeff, I'm the fifth person on this show that feels the power of the secret spot. Kind of has to do with my statement here. I have a chance to provide ecotourism access to some very unique and rare llama and sandalwood forest. And, my neighbors and I on the plus side stand to make some good money off of the tours. But it means providing access to forest that is not currently known about. What do you guys think of that?
I think a lot of people are going to have a problem with that. Let's bring in John from Volcano, who I'm pretty sure will have a problem with that. John, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
You
hear me?
You're saying that loving the land, tourism is just flat out a danger to the Aina, yeah?
I'm suggesting that if you just take a geologic view of Hawaii, tourism has been like a natural disaster. Does anybody even talk anymore about the Hawaiian birds or the Hawaiian snails or the Hawaiian plants or the ohia, which is dying? I don't hear anybody in tourism going, tourism should be about saving the ohia because the ohia is Hawaii, and Hawaii is what we're bringing people to see. I see tourism entirely avoiding the issue because of the internal contradiction. Right, we don't have a way yet to have tourism without creating stress on the land.
Jeff, are you still with us, Jeff Bolin? I want to get your response to what he just said. You there? I'm sorry, I was reaching out to Jeff Bolin of Sustainable.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah.
Well, look, the I don't think sustainable tourism, there is a history of sustainable tourism, meaning for people, ecotourism, swinging through trees and forest visits, whatnot. And I just think that's a segment of tourism. So that
that aside, I have a tough time with the arguments of data and the economics purely saying, you know, you can build more, you can mitigate. You know, that sort of ignores the fact that there is a finite resource here, which there are forces and special interests that will keep people from building. And so the answer of build more housing is fine until someone says, but don't build it by me. So, you know, there's an ugly piece to tourism. And it's the following, which is more and more and more undoubtedly needs to more and more impact. And the question becomes, how does one manage and mitigate that impact? You know, technology has a role. Regulation absolutely has a role. But Waikiki is really crowded and incredibly crowded. And, you know, you wonder... even though people keep coming, is that the experience that the state wants to represent and that destination wants to represent? Cheek to jowl on the beach, cheek to jowl by the pool. You really can't. It's not a lot there to see and do. Is that the brand and that the experience? And so you start thinking about how do you respond? You mitigate, right? You do try and mitigate. Whether it's sunscreen, numbers, regulation, timing, vehicle flow, whatever it might be. You still have. The glass is still quite full, if not overflowing. How do you ultimately do that? And this is the nasty story sometimes, which is, you know, you start playing with price. I mean, I think as you said, the former owner from Outrigger, at a certain point you start playing with price because the stadium holds 50,000 people, the club or the concert hall might hold 10,000, and you know, you can only fit a certain number of people in there. And I think. If it's a very tough argument to say, yeah, well, okay, we'll expand the concert hall. Oh, there are buildings next to the concert hall, right? You can't just expand it from today to tomorrow, and it's the same thing. So the reef is a certain size, the beach is a certain size, and the experience is a certain characteristics. And so in Cozumel, they have, 80,000 residents and 16,000 tourists a day coming in. On the cruise ships, the cruise. I don't know if you see the cruise liners paying for the cost of the water, or the other impacts they have. But that's a lot of tourists in a very small location at one period of time. I don't know how many mechanisms there are other than to say we cap it or we charge them more, and we use those extra charges to mitigate some of the impact, whether it's a social or environmental. So I think there's it's not an easy picture, but there's a reality that comes at some point the glass is full. And how do you keep that glass from overflowing? Well, you regulate it, you start charging people money so they self-decide not to go there.
Jeff, I want to bring in one last caller whose concern is with what you were just talking about with impacts. This is Billy from Haiku. Are you on the line, Billy?
Yes, I'm calling about, I've been here for years, and one thing about Hawaii is all about the beaches. And since the tourists and bed and breakfast moved in, we have lost a lot of beach access that landowners are trying to block, overgrowing them with bushes. Fishermen are losing their fishing rights over here. And I've seen this going on pretty rapidly, and I think that's a concern because, first of all, those people building them nice houses on the beaches don't want them pathways there, but I think it'll encourage them to build somewhere else instead of by that pathway.
Thanks, Billy. You know, Paul and Bill and Jeff, I don't know if we've answered too many questions here, but it certainly is an indication of the kind of questions that are flying around in the air.
Yeah, but again, I have to say that I don't think that it's quite as confounding as it sort of sounds when we throw everything up.
Well, it does sound confounding, yeah.
But, well, what I'm saying is that there are ways to mitigate resource impacts. And there are ways to, you know, make tourism more responsive to bearing the cost, the burden of the cost that it is responsible for having contributed. But a lot of those impacts are, you know, need to be mitigated regardless of who the user is. We're not that far away from actually solving the problems. If we can get past this fake argument that tourism is the reason why the problems exist,
Jeff, real quick, we're running short on time, but some thoughts from you, final thoughts?
I think for the first time in either recent history or as far back, and I can recall, that tourism is seen as a negative, and that's manifesting itself in, as I said, over tourism. You've seen protests, and people are pointing at Airbnb, and people point a lot of things, but the reality is there are protests, and it's in the media. And quite simply, I'll go back to what I said before. I think it's just not reasonable to say we can solve everything, but why blame tourism? Well, you know, the 1 in 10 jobs around the globe, growth in numbers, growth in construction, growth in effluence, growth in all those, sure. I have a toilet and it flushes from my house, and from the business, people wash their hands and the water come out as well, as do the 9 million tourists. I think there's an inordinate impact in Hawaii and other places. And so I think I'd like to say it's good that tourism finally is seeing some negative, because it's time to wake up and realize that if you don't protect and invest in the asset, that's an active choice you're making.
Well, that's certainly something we keep hearing. Thank you very much, Jeff. We want to thank economist Paul Brubaker and Jeff Bolin, CEO of Sustainable Travel International, for being with us, and to News Director Bill Dorman and all of you who called in and joined in that conversation. You can always call our talk back line about this and any other topic. It's a different number from the one the callers just used. This is 808-792-8217. 808-792-8217.
Support for today's programming comes from Hawaii Symphony Orchestra. The new season begins with Dvorak's New World Symphony and Brahms Piano Concerto No. 2, 4 p.m. Sunday, October 1st, hisymphony.org.
Friday is the day we look at what our news department is up to and what stories are being prepared for the coming week. So Bill Dorman, our news director, is sitting right next to me.
Yes, I am, Chris. Good morning. Interesting set of conversations.
Really was, yeah.
On tourism today and all week.
Yeah.
You know, one headline for next week, Hawaii Public Radio's pledge drive starts in the middle of the week. So we have reporter pieces early part of the week, and then we'll be shifting over to pledge drive. Although we do maintain local news segments on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and certainly here on The Conversation,
yep,
we'll be rolling ahead. And regular feature segments, Stargazer, Asia Minute, a couple of other things going. But, you know, I did want to take a couple of minutes this morning to respond to some listener reaction to an interview that
Please.
We had this past week. And this one was not about tourism, actually, but with John Purcell, the head of global research and development for Monsanto. Now, you two talked on Tuesday about global food production. We touched on some of Monsanto's operations here in Hawaii, but that wasn't the focus of the segment.
Right.
It was more along the lines of feeding a hungry world.
Yeah.
The United Nations says more than 800 million people globally are undernourished. You talked about trends in food production, changes in agriculture, and some of that related to genetic modification, also to simple breeding of plants, education, a wide-ranging conversation. And we've done stories and spoken with guests about many aspects of Monsanto's presence in Hawaii, the nature of the seed business, companies' use of pesticides, GMOs, Monsanto's impact on different islands. And we'll return to those in the future as well, but as you and I talked, and the production team here talked, before we went on the air, we knew that this would provoke some
reaction.
Yes,
we did, yeah.
And to be honest, for some folks, no matter what was said and no matter the topic, the headline that someone from Monsanto would be on the program was enough to spark angry reaction,
mm-hmm,
and we got some. Just for example, Cambria Moss and Joel Gold, among those listeners, urging us to interview Vincent Mana, he's the president of Hawaii Farmers Union United, about food security in Hawaii. And Vincent's certainly knowledgeable, a familiar voice. He's actually been on this program 3 times in the past year. We're likely to hear from him again at some point, and as we address that topic. But this idea of providing room for many sides of the conversation is very important, and that includes Monsanto. By the way, that's the first time someone from Monsanto has been on this program since 2013.
Yeah.
You know, part of this program, generally, no one gets a pass. You talked about the intensely negative reaction Monsanto produces in a lot of Hawaii, but also nobody gets beaten up. The goal is not gotcha. It's illumination. It's talking with folks who have different viewpoints. It's doing so with civility and aloha. And mahalo to all of you for being in touch and letting us know what you think.
Well, it's about finding out what people have to say, Bill, and that's really our function, isn't it?
It's true, and a lot of polarizing issues out there, but it's important to get them on the table and talk about them and not just pretend they don't exist.
Amen. Thanks very much, Bill.
You betcha.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director.